Part 6. Desperate Times. Convictions are more dangerous foes of truth than lies. Friedrich Nietzsche. G-34. Stevenson Farm, Eastview, Colorado. There was no need for a closer look. There was no need for a longer look. There was quite simply no mistaking it. Phil Norris was dead. Clark McCarthy's hands instinctively shot up to cover his own face and nose while his eyes closed in reaction to the harrowing sight before them. His phone had fallen to the ground and its flashlight was now shining up at him, the only clear source of light in the shadowy and otherwise vacant cornfield. While there was no need to look at Phil any closer or longer to discern that he was sadly and decisively gone for good, Clark did his best to temporarily shake away the grief and reached down to pick up his phone. There was a need to look for some sign of what had happened, as uncomfortable as it was to do so, and with this in mind, Clark stayed crouched at the knee after taking hold of his phone and turned it to illuminate Phil. Phil was lying face up, but a relatively thorough look over gave Clark no insight as to the cause of his death. There was no gunshot wound and no sign of a blunt impact, at least on the front of his body. And Clark, likewise, saw no rips or tears in Phil's clothing, which might have indicated his participation in a physical struggle of some kind. In this absence of any obvious clues, Clark momentarily began to doubt his prior assumption that the rest of the cornfield was vacant and had been all along. If nothing physical had happened to Phil, he considered, maybe something alien had after all. Maybe he hit a force field like the kind in Lolo, Clark thought. Not the kind I couldn't get past when they put one here, but the kind that made it feel like my brain was going to explode when I did pass it. With nothing else to go on, this currently made as much sense to Clark as anything else, fighting his own natural instinct to call the police, particularly strong given his closeness to the local officers he had worked alongside until fairly recently, he bore in mind Phil's insistence, present for one reason or another, on keeping the authorities out of things. Clark knew that any attempts at secrecy couldn't go on forever, not with a body lying in a cornfield and one of Birchwood's best-known faces soon to be conspicuously absent from New Care Grillin and everywhere else, but he also knew that it wasn't his place to act rashly without consulting the others who were still in town. Four of the usual inner circle members were currently out of the picture while on duty elsewhere, but even without Dan, Tara, Billy, or Timo, Clark still had his father, Mr. Bird, and perhaps most importantly, Emma, to lean upon in formulating a way of moving forward and working out as quickly as possible what had happened to Phil and what implications it could have for everyone else. Bird, Clark sighed out loud. The news would break the old man's heart, but Clark was going to have to break it. This was a weight on his shoulders like no other, and it prompted him to make absolutely sure that Phil wasn't in any kind of partially suspended state that may have come about if the force field-centric theory of alien involvement was closer to the truth than the balance of probabilities made it feel. This final check was intended to make sure Clark didn't give Mr. Bird a premature and false report of Phil's death that would cause him undue stress, and was conducted in the extremely faint hope that he wouldn't have to report it at all. The open mouth and evident limpness had already convinced Clark McCarthy that he was now looking at a corpse rather than a friend, but he desperately watched Phil's chest for the better part of 10 seconds and prayed to see a breath. None came. There really had been no mistaking it since the very first glance, but with the death of even the tremendously faint hope Clark had felt prior to this final confirmation came a second dose of almost physically overwhelming dejection. Clark knew that feeling for a pulse would have been pointless at this point, as well as potentially dangerous given the possible implications for any forthcoming forensic analysis, in the same way that rolling Phil over to look for any signs of impact or injury would have been. So he took several seconds to regain control over his breathing and push himself upright against the resistance of 2 grief-weakened knees. With the heaviest heart he had ever felt within his broad chest, Clark then exited the cornfield as quickly as his legs would take him and made the short walk to deliver the terrible news to Mr. Bird. He ran through several ways to say it, but none stuck out as any easier than the rest. His focus wasn't on how easily the words would come out, but more on how they would enter Mr. Bird's mind. There was no way to sugarcoat news like this, Clark knew, but it was still worth trying to be tactful. Phil and Mr. Bird, each having lived in or around Birchwood for a full 40 years, went back even further with each other than either did with Henry and his McCarthy family. With this in mind, Clark recognized that while he had been the unfortunate one to have made the discovery, he wasn't the one who had just lost his best friend. He and Phil had grown close in recent times, far closer than he had once thought possible, given Phil's reputation for cantankerous grouchiness and his often stated desire for solitude, but nowhere near as close as Phil and Mr. Bird had been since the days before Clark was even born. Despite the firmness of Clark's previous order to stay in the car, and because he was walking back from the cornfield unharmed in a manner that made clear there was no immediate threat, Mr. Bird stepped out of the car to impatiently inquire as to what, if anything, he had found in there. Clark didn't reply, but he didn't have to. Before he got much closer, his face became visible under the farmhouse's floodlights and sent the message to Mr. Bird loud and clear that he had stumbled upon something awful. The context of their impromptu late-night visit meant that it didn't take a genius, or even a particularly active imagination, to take an educated guess at what this might be, so Mr. Bird's legs carried him towards Clark until they met halfway. "No," the old man said, gazing into the senior McCarthy brother's dry but harrowed eyes. "Clark, no." Clark gulped. "I'm sorry." As though he had been shot from behind, Mr. Bird slumped immediately into Clark. He took some catching, still being a relatively well-built man despite his age, given an almost religious adherence to the mid-level fitness regimen he had stuck to since his long years as a sheriff's deputy, but the physical weight Clark felt on his shoulder was nothing compared to the emotional one. Clark was used to playing the role of a Birchwood oak, standing tall and firm in the face of whatever came his friends and family's way, so that their lives at least had one dependable constant to lean on, but never before had he been forced to stand up to something like this. Things had been difficult in the past few years, over and over again, and the period when Henry's long hospitalization as a comatose patient had coincided with the unprecedented level of often hostile media scrutiny that fell upon Dan after his IDA leak had been particularly challenging. As tough as those times had been, however, like the aftermath of the grave and initially life-threatening injuries Emma and Timo had to battle through following the Fiore Frontieri bombing, no one had died. Until now, no one had died. The likes of Ben Gold and Richard Walker were no longer around, of course, but for all the tumult and chaos that recent years had dumped upon Birchwood, Colorado, and its most prominent family in particular, this was the first time anyone moderately close to them had passed on. That Phil was a lot more than moderately close, being a fully looped-in member of the inner circle as he was, made things even harder to handle. All of a sudden, many of the small troubles that had been circling in various recesses of Clark McCarthy's mind and popping to the forefront every so often felt like they would never bother him again. Compared to this, he knew that few things ever could. Anything that brought the fine line between life and death into focus could lead to these kinds of existential considerations, but typically they came after some kind of near miss that made Clark feel grateful for the life he had. With this, however, there was nothing to be grateful for. All there was room for was confusion, sadness, and anger. None of those three words came close to describing the tempest of emotions swirling within Clark, who wasn't yet sure who to be angry at, but had already vowed to himself that he would find out as soon as humanly possible and make them answer for what they'd done just as quickly. Death was too good for them, and they would be wishing for it before long.